Chapter 2. The Big Money Plot to Overthrow FDR. The Incident. A coup attempt by some of the titans of Wall Street to overthrow Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1934 and put a military man in charge of the country. The official word: the plotters were foiled when the man they selected, Major General Smedley Butler, blew the whistle to Congress. My take? This was an attempt to turn America into a fascist country run by corporate powers, but it's been ignored in most official histories of the Great Depression. The liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power to a point where it becomes stronger than their democratic state itself. That, in its essence, is fascism. Ownership of government by an individual, by a group, or by any controlling private power. Franklin D. Roosevelt. I would think that a coup to overthrow our government and turn us into a fascist state ought to make it into our history books. That way we could read about it and hopefully learn from it so that we don't live to repeat it. But this certainly wasn't taught in any public school curriculum that I saw. You learned about Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New Deal. Never did I hear about leaders of business during that era literally setting out to have a coup. I don't consider myself dumb or not well-read, but researching this book is the first I've come across this story. That was when I came across a book originally published in the 70s called The Plot to Seize the White House, by an investigative journalist named Jules Archer. Yet back in the 1930s, the plot had been fully documented in congressional hearings, although in the end they decided not to name certain names, also by some of the big media, even though they downplayed the whole thing. I find it interesting that we do learn about a couple of traitors in American history. Benedict Arnold and Aaron Burr come to mind, but once again they're more of the lone nut variety. Rich and powerful titans of finance wouldn't stoop to such a thing, right? Well, if it hadn't been that they tried buying off the wrong man to be their puppet, quite possibly we'd have been living in a country not that far removed from Hitler's Germany or Mussolini's Italy. That man was Major General Smedley Darlington Butler, one of the great unsung heroes in our history. But he's not exactly a household word, is he? A little background first. FDR, after getting elected in 1932 in the midst of the Great Depression, started implementing his New Deal. He took on the stock speculators and set up new watchdog agencies. He put a stop to farm foreclosures and made employers accept collective bargaining by the unions. And he took the country off the gold standard, meaning that more paper money could be available to create jobs for the unemployed and provide loans. That outraged some of the conservative financiers. FDR went even further and started talking about raising their taxes to help pay for these programs. So the oligarchs of finance hated him and everything he stood for on behalf of the common man. They considered the new president a traitor to his own class, namely them. Within a year of FDR's taking office, they'd started hatching a plan to get rid of him. The plotters' idea was to enlist a military man who was popular with veterans from the First World War. Many veterans were disgruntled because they'd never been paid the bonuses promised them when the war ended. When their bonus army protested by camping out in Washington in 1932, Smedley Butler had shown up to support their cause. He was the most decorated Marine in American history. And when another general, Douglas MacArthur, led a charge to destroy the veterans' tent city under orders from President Hoover, Butler got so pissed off that he switched parties and voted for FDR in the election that year. But maybe the coup makers didn't know that when they decided Butler was the man to lead their takeover of the government. Or maybe they figured that with enough money and the temptation of running the country, anybody was corruptible. The idea was to create havoc by Major General Butler leading a veterans' march on Washington. Pressured by these events, FDR, so they thought, would be convinced to name Butler to a new cabinet post as a Secretary of General Affairs, or General Welfare. Homeland Security would have to wait a while longer. Eventually, the president would agree to turn over the reins of power to Butler altogether, under the excuse that his polio was worsening and would become a ceremonial figurehead. The whole notion seems pretty far-fetched today, especially given what we know about the integrity of Roosevelt through the Depression and World War II. Apparently, though, the Wall Street group thought they could pull it off. But they sure didn't do enough homework on the military man they thought would play along, Smedley Butler. He'd grown up in a politically prominent Quaker family in Pennsylvania and gotten his baptism under fire with the Marines at Guantanamo during the Spanish-American War. During his distinguished service, he would come under fire more than 120 times and receive 18 decorations, including 3 Medals of Honor. As a good soldier, Butler followed orders. The Taft administration asked him to help rig elections in Nicaragua, which he later admitted doing. In what was then called dollar diplomacy, Butler also helped American business interests maintain their hold on other Latin American countries. If that's all they knew about Butler, it's understandable that the conspirators against FDR might figure he'd play along. But he'd given a speech to an American Legion convention the year before FDR was elected that clearly showed he'd had a change of heart. When the Legion first formed in the 1920s, most veterans had no clue that big corporations were backing it to use later in breaking strikes. It turned out that one of the Legion's main founders was Grayson Murphy, who ran one of Wall Street's big brokerage firms, along with being director of a Morgan Bank Guarantee Trust. His name would soon surface as one of the financiers who wanted to remove FDR from power. In his speech, Butler decided to give the Legion veterans some insight into how things worked. "I spent 33 years being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers," Butler said. "In short, I was a racketeer for capitalism. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1909 through 1912. I helped make Mexico and especially Tampico safe for American oil interests in 1916. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenue in. I helped in the rape of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. In China in 1927, I helped see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested. I had a swell racket. I was rewarded with honors, medals, promotions. I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was operate a racket in 3 cities. The Marines operated on 3 continents." In another talk, Butler told veterans that war was largely a matter of money. Bankers lend money to foreign countries, and when they cannot repay, the president sends Marines to get it. "I know. I've been in 11 of these expeditions." Butler also told the vets not to believe the propaganda that capital circulates in the controlled press. In 1932, the year after he gave that speech, at the age of 50, Butler retired to civilian life. He handed out maps to his house to Marines who'd served under him, in case they ever needed anything. Butler speculated privately that the unsuccessful assassination attempt on Roosevelt a few weeks before his inauguration might have been orchestrated by a big business cabal. Now, members of that same elite circle decided that Butler, not MacArthur, was the military man best able to lead their coup attempt. One day, they had a bond salesman named Jerry Maguire approach him. Butler quickly smelled a rat, but decided to play along until they could figure out what was really going on. Over the course of some months, McGuire courted him. His employer turned out to be Legion sponsor and financier Grayson Murphy. There were some important people, McGuire told Butler, who wanted to establish a new organization in the U.S. They had money, lots of it, $3 million in working capital and as much as $300 million that could be tapped into. Butler realized the truth of this when some captains of industry came together and announced formation of a new American Liberty League in September 1934. The organization said its goals were to combat radicalism, to teach the necessity of respect for the rights of persons and property, and generally to foster free private enterprise. Backers included Rockefellers, Mellons, and Pews. Also two unsuccessful Democratic presidential candidates, John W. Davis, an attorney for the Morgan banking interests, and Al Smith, a business associate of the DuPonts. At first, Butler couldn't believe even Smith could be involved, until he suddenly published a scathing attack on the New Deal. I guess you could say not a whole lot has changed with our two-party system. Butler had once served with a fellow named Robert S. Clark, an heir to the Singer sewing machine fortune and a wealthy banker. He now paid a visit and put forward more of the plan to Butler, who remembered Clark saying, "You know, the president is weak. He was raised in this class, and he will come back, but we have got to be prepared to sustain him when he does." So Butler was their choice to lead the takeover. I view Smedley Butler as someone who'd read the Constitution and followed the law. He didn't have to be in FDR's camp to realize that what he was being asked to do was wrong. FDR was the commander-in-chief of the country, and we have a system for how we exchange our leaders. That system is the vote and the election. Butler brought a reporter friend in on the conspiracy, so it wouldn't be just his word against the plotters. Together they worked on gathering more background. Around Thanksgiving in 1934, the McCormick-Dickstein Committee of the House of Representatives took Butler's testimony behind closed doors. The next day, the New York Times ran a two-column headline on the front page. General Butler bears fascist plot to seize government by force. Butler was struck by how the paper played it. The gist of his charges was buried deep inside, while most of the article consisted of denials and outright ridicule from some of the prominent people he'd implicated. Time magazine followed up with a front-page piece headlined, "Plot Without Plotters." It caricatured Butler riding a white horse while asking veterans to follow him. No military officer of the United States since the late tempestuous George Custer has succeeded in publicly floundering in so much hot water as Smedley Darlington Butler, the article said snidely. Are we surprised that FDR started his fireside chats so he could go straight to the people and over the heads of media barons like Luce and Hearst? The House committee went ahead and commenced a two-month-long investigation. It verified an $18,000 bribe offered to Butler and came up with a number of other facts to verify his story. The VFW commander, James Van Zandt, revealed that he had also been approached by agents of Wall Street to lead a fascist dictatorship. Even Time, which 12 weeks before had made fun of the plot idea, came out with a small print footnote that the committee was convinced that General Butler's story of a fascist march on Washington was alarmingly true. After that, though, the committee's investigation came to a sudden stop. They never called any of the big financiers for questioning. In fact, when the transcript of the committee's interview with Butler appeared, all the names he'd named were deleted. Some said that the names were omitted at the request of a member of FDR's cabinet, who didn't want to embarrass the two former Democratic presidential candidates that Butler identified. FDR never made any comment on the plot, so we can't know what he might have said behind closed doors. Maybe he figured, now that this was public knowledge, he needn't to pursue it further. Maybe he dismissed the plan as a preposterous idea. For whatever reason, the Justice Department avoided any steps toward fuller investigation. That caused Roger Baldwin of the ACLU to issue an angry statement. Not a single participant will be prosecuted under the perfectly plain language of the Federal Conspiracy Act, making this a high crime. Does this remind anyone of the current administration not wanting to prosecute the Bush people for their involvement in torture? When Jules Archer interviewed John McCormick in 1971, the former House Speaker claimed he couldn't remember why his committee had stayed away from implicating the bankers and corporate presidents. McCormick did say, "If the plotters had got rid of Roosevelt, there's no telling what might have taken place. They wouldn't have told the people what they were doing, of course. They were going to make it all sound constitutional, of course, with a high-sounding name for the dictator, and a plan to make it all sound like a good American program. A well-organized minority can always outmaneuver an unorganized majority, as Adolf Hitler did. The people were in a very confused state of mind, making the nation weak and ripe for some drastic kind of extremist reaction. Mass frustration could bring about anything." Even though this happened more than 75 years ago, it's worth paying attention to where the plot came from and how its would-be perpetrators haven't necessarily gone away, but only taken on different faces. Let me start to explain that by telling you about a book called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. It was written by a Georgetown University professor named Carol Quigley, a well-connected academic who had many friends and associates among the elite class. One of his students was Bill Clinton. In Tragedy and Hope, Quigley wrote, "There does exist, and has existed for a generation, an international Anglophile network which operates to some extent in the way the radical right believes the communists act. In fact, this network, which we may identify as the Round Table Groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists or any other groups, and frequently does so. I know of the operations of this network because I have studied it for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the early 1960s to examine its papers and secret records. I have no aversion to it or to most of its aims, and have for much of my life been close to it and many of its instruments. In general, my chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown, and I believe its role in history is significant enough to be known." Quigley says it all began with a wealthy Englishman named Cecil Rhodes, who'd worked with financiers like the Rothschilds to gain pretty much of a monopoly over South Africa's diamonds and gold. The Rhodes Scholarships, established by the terms of Cecil Rhodes's seventh will, are known to everyone. What is not so widely known is that Rhodes, in 5 previous wills, left his fortune to form a secret society, which was to devote itself to the preservation and expansion of the British Empire. Funding for the widely ramified activities of this organization later came from groups associated with J.P. Morgan, the Rockefeller, and Whitney families. In looking to expand after the First World War, front organizations were set up: the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London and in New York, the Council on Foreign Relations, CFR, a front group for J.P. Morgan and Company in association with the very small American Round Table Group. The CFR in 1928, according to Quigley's list, had John W. Davis as its president, the very same fellow who, along with Morgan and others, established the American Liberty League that tried to use General Butler in the plot against FDR. Also among the CFR's leading lights was attorney Alan Dulles, future director of the CIA, and member of the Warren Commission to investigate JFK's assassination. And, closely allied with this Morgan influence, were a small group of Wall Street law firms that included another future Warren Commission member, John McCloy. Same cast of characters, from FDR to JFK. The goal of this cabal of global financiers, writes Quigley, was nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world acting in concert, by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. Each central bank sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans, to manipulate foreign exchanges, to influence the level of economic activity in the country, and to influence cooperative politicians by subsequent economic rewards in the business world. Then there was this. The American branch of this English establishment exerted much of its influence through five American newspapers: the New York Times, New York Herald Tribune, Christian Science Monitor, the Washington Post, and the lamented Boston Evening. Economic rewards in the business world. Then there was this. The American branch of this English establishment exerted much of its influence through five American newspapers: the New York Times, New York Herald Tribune, Christian Science Monitor, the Washington Post, and the lamented Boston Evening Transcript. Quigley's book is back in print today, but when it first appeared in 1966, it didn't stay long on bookstore shelves. The professor came to believe it had been suppressed, because it apparently says something which powerful people do not want known. As I've expanded my study of conspiracies, I find that I'm often getting the same information from two separate sources. Let me insert here something about the Bilderbergs. For a TV series I'm doing on conspiracies, we interviewed a fellow named Daniel Estulin, an investigative journalist from Spain who's been researching the Bilderberg secret society for more than 17 years. It turns out the wealthiest CEOs of the world have been coming together with a political elite from Europe and America since 1954, when they first met at Bilderberg Hotel in a little Dutch town called Oosterbeek. The Bilderberg deep pockets reach back centuries to royalty, who still believe they're the entitled ones and the rest of us are merely cannon fodder. Banker David Rockefeller, at the 1991 Bilderberg meeting, is said to have argued for one world government of an intellectual elite and world bankers. But I was told that within this group, David Rockefeller is a waiter, meaning at his level, he would bring the other members drinks as mid-level help. The others are much more powerful. To get a sense of the continuity among the power brokers, in Tragedy and Hope, Professor Quigley doesn't mention Prescott Bush, the grandfather of George W., or of George Herbert Walker, the grandfather of George H.W., but both of them were among the right-wing elite on Wall Street during FDR's day. In 2007, an American investigative journalist named John Buchanan found documents from the McCormick-Dickstein Committee in the National Archives. These directly linked Prescott Bush to the power brokers, Morgan, DuPont, Remington, and others, who were behind the plan to get rid of FDR. This got some play in the UK, but not a word in the mainstream American press. But if you check out Kevin Phillips' book on the Bush family, American Dynasty, you can find some interesting cross-references. Dating back to the First World War, George Herbert Walker, Prescott's father-in-law, was involved with a frequently collaborative group of money men, Averell Harriman, Percy Rockefeller at National City Bank, and others at Guarantee Trust, who had large international plans. Remember that one of the anti-FDR coup leaders had ties to Guaranty Trust. In 1919, National City Bank joined in setting up the new W.A. Harriman & Company, soon to be under George Walker's presidency, and including Remington Samuel Pryor as part of this cabal. 5 years later, Harriman and Walker established the Union Banking Corporation, UBC, in New York, on behalf of the politically active German steel baron Fritz Thyssen, a major funder of Hitler's Nazi Party. Prescott Bush and a number of his Skull and Bones pals from Yale came together under one roof through the Brown Brothers Harriman merger in 1931. Phillips doesn't bring the Smedley-Butler story into his book, but he goes on to say, "Unfortunately, we have no reliable way of knowing exactly why, after 1933, men like Averell Harriman, George Walker, and Prescott Bush, the Dulles brothers, James Forrestal, Henry Ford, and several Rockefellers, maintained investment relationships with Hitler's Germany, in a few cases up to and even after Pearl Harbor." By the late 1930s, Brown Brothers Harriman and Dillon Reed were two notable active investors in a Germany rapidly rearming under Adolf Hitler. Prescott Bush handled much of the German work at Brown Brothers Harriman, working closely with Wall Street lawyers Allen and John Foster Dulles. Prescott was also a director of the UBC Bank that Brown Brothers Harriman ran for the German Thyssen Steel family. In 1941, the New York Herald Tribune had featured a front-page story headlined, "Hitler's Angel Has $3 Million in U.S. Bank," that Thyssen was possibly holding for Nazi bigwigs. In October 1942, the federal government then seized the assets of the Union Banking Corporation under the Trading with the Enemy Act. Prescott Bush went on to be a U.S. senator from Connecticut. The Dulles brothers ran the CIA and the State Department under Eisenhower. Averell Harriman ended up governor of New York. It is almost as if these various German embroilments, despite their potential for scandal, were regarded as unfortunate but, in essence, business as usual, Kevin Phillips writes. So maybe that's how the FDR plot was conceived, too. Business as usual, which the president's New Deal was obstructing. Smedley Butler did his best to issue the warning. Lecturing around the country as spokesman for the Forgotten Veteran, the general accused the big industrialists of bloating themselves on the blood of the soldiers in the First World War. He pointed out that DuPont's profits had soared from only $6 million before the conflict to $58 million in the course of it. Similar huge jumps were made by companies like Bethlehem Steel and International Nickel. Munitions, as the war to end all wars proved, was a mighty profitable enterprise. Butler also asked a question in his book, War is a Racket, that I've thought about a lot in terms of today. How many of these war millionaires shouldered a rifle? His idea was, let the officers and directors and the high-powered executives of our armament factories and our steel companies and our munitions makers and our shipbuilders and our airplane builders, as well as the bankers and the speculators, be conscripted to get $30 a month, the same wage as the lads in the trenches get. Do you think we'd have gone to war in Iraq if Dick Cheney and his Halliburton buddies were subject to Butler's idea? The Fighting Quaker, as he was called, died in 1940, so he never lived to see America enter the war against Germany and Japan. Today we owe the man a great debt, as someone courageous enough to blow the whistle on the big money forces out to undermine our democracy. Too bad there wasn't another Smedley Butler around when George W. Bush stole two presidential elections. That's a story we'll get to in due course. Getting back to the Bilderbergs and the scary notion, Is this attempt to control the world real? I don't think it's necessarily a case of a dozen guys sitting around a table deciding our future, but I do think that these power brokers, bankers, money men of the world have the power to try to control the direction we're going. Can they guarantee it? Never, because you've always got the human element, and they don't seem to want to rouse the ire of the masses. They're sneakier than that. I found it interesting that the same day that the Bilderberg expert, Daniel Estulin, was to meet with me in New York, our filming schedule got thrown off. I had to wait an extra day, because he happened to be on the no-fly list. It took 24 hours for him to be cleared and come talk to me. I was trying to figure out why they would deem this guy a terrorist. I mean, he's a writer. Who would have the power to put him on that list? What are the qualifications? Like Shakespeare once put it, "Oh, what a tangled web we weave." It makes me want to run to the Baja for 6 months and get away from it all. But by the time I'm ready to go, I'll probably be on the no-fly list, too. I'll keep you posted. What should we do now? We need real heroes for our young people to emulate. Individuals who weren't afraid to take a stand for the sake of our country. The story of Major General Smedley Butler needs to be as widely known as those of Washington and Lincoln. If this means making us think about the fact that wealthy people can sometimes be out for evil purposes, so be it. I'd rank Professor Quigley as a hero, too, for his willingness to expose the secret machinations of the rich and powerful. Again, let's revise our history textbooks.